escape, you inhabitants of beautiful Shaphir, naked and in shame. The sheep of Zanaan have not departed. By morning of the narrows of Bethesel, your standing place has been reduced. That's Micah chapter 1, verse 11. Micah 1:11 of the version from yours truly from 2003, our daily scripture, Little Children for Today. And in Clark's commentary, he talks about what these places are. Shaphir, he says, is the strongest place in Galilee. And Calmet, he mentions Calmet. Well, that's according to the person called Calmet, right? And according to Who Be Gone, Kelme actually would be the pronunciation of the French name. But Who Be Gone says it was a city in the tribe of Judah between Eleutheropolis and Ascalon. And Zaanan, Clark says, is another city in the tribe of Judah. And Bethesel is a place near Jerusalem, according to Adam Clark, who says also that Jerusalem, some think, was the place intended by the name Bethesel. And we've seen that Micah's prophecy is about the people of God. It's a prophecy about the inhabitants of Judah. And regarding, it says here, he visioned, of course, it says, at Samaria, these things, and at Jerusalem. During the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, and we have their dating, with Hezekiah ruling beginning in 725 BCE, and 16 years for each of the previous two, would be 32 added to 725. I'm just doing this right now in my head because that's 757, is that right? Something like that. For the beginning of the rule of Jotham. That's what I get, anyway, in my head. I guess I don't have to do it in my head because I've got a calculator. Let's see. 725 plus 32. 757, approximately, would be the beginning of the rule of Jotham. That would be in the Moses article. And if you're trying to click on the link for the Moses article in our study, the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. Speaking of which, we're beginning the last paragraph of that article today. It's in part 2 and it's chapter 12, paragraph 12. But in the previous paragraph, there was a link that you might have wanted to click on for the article Moses. So if you click on that, what happens is this happens. It's not found because I changed the name later. So if you want to fix that, you go to the name just before the .htm in the name, the .htm, just prior to the dot, you insert part, P-A-R-T, hyphen one, part, hyphen one. Press enter, then it finds part one of that article. In fact, it will find a specific place in that article, but that is how you get there if you are interested in that link. I also want to talk about milk today, if we get around to it. I was intending to say that, but I might as well say it now because we won't have time if I don't get to it now. The problem with cow's milk is that cow's milk has more of the A2 casein protein, whereas goat's milk has very little, and so does sheep's milk, and there are other animals too, like yaks and buffalo, that have primarily the A1 protein. And the A1 is the one that causes less difficulty, let's say, for people. there are some people who have difficulty with the A2 protein. And in Europe, the cows tend to produce, because of the different varieties they have in Europe, they produce more of the A2. So some of the European cheeses, for example, the imported cheese or the cheese from milk in Europe, is causing less problem, let's put it that way, for people, because we don't really know everything about it yet. But they're researching it. Let's just say that's enough of that. So it's not because of the number of stomachs. I was told that it was, well, somebody told me that it was because cows have a lot of stomachs or something, but I wrongly misinterpreted that as meaning that goats and sheep do not have multiple stomachs, but they do. They also chew the cud. So it's not because of the chewing of the cud or anything that's causing the difference. Goat's milk is more similar to human milk. And so that's true of also sheep's milk and buffalo and yak's milk. And there's a list of animals whose milk is more compatible with the human body. So, and also, some people might even say that, as I find, for example, that there's more flavor in goat's milk than there is in cow's milk. And the same with sheep's milk. Cow's milk is rather bland, but organic, the organic cow's milk I was getting, that's so good. I don't react badly to it. Maybe it's from the right variety of cow. It's got to do with the variety of cow. Like, does it talk about that here? Yes, it does. The breeds of cows that produce A1 beta casein. It's the beta casein that is the A1 or A2. And the breeds that produce A1 are Holstein, Friesian, Ayrshire, and British Shorthorn. Although, you know, they're not normally 100% A1 protein. It's just a certain percentage. But A2 beta casein is high and in certain breeds that originated in the Channel Islands and southern France, you see, including Guernsey, Jersey, Charolais, and Limousin cows. So I find there's a difference in some of the milk that I drink, that I really notice a difference. And it very likely could be this A2 beta casein that is found to be, according to some studies, better, right, and safer. That's all I want to say about that particular thing. But let's come back to our article. I wanted to show you the ARC site. There's this map, right? So if you go to the map, if you click on the link for the Noah's Ark Visitors Center, just go to the Wikimapia search tab and type in Ark of Noah, search for that. That will bring up, let's see what happens, this Dhirupanar Formation, Noah's Ark. It says Dhirupanar Formation. When you see that link, it's not at Dugubyazıt, Turkey. It's not at that location. It's just a certain number. It's close. Like, see, Dugubyazıt is Dugubyazıt is a certain number of miles away from the Noah's Ark site. But because it's the closest large city, they call it, they locate it there. But let's click on that Dhirupanar Formation, which is not at Dugubyazıt exactly, but click on it. It shows you the shape of a boat. Noah's Ark, it appears. Then you can just zoom in on that, or zoom out from that. You can see the visitor center over there, tourist center right there near the Ark, and then you can zoom out some more, and you can eventually get to the point where you see the big city there and the tiny crosshair is still showing the location of Noah's Ark relative to the city of Dugubyazıt. Probably not pronouncing it right, but that's the Turkish city that's fairly large that's nearby. So 40 days after the tops of the mountains appeared, beginning to read now, paragraph 12 of our article, in chapter 12, Noah opened the window, and he sent out a raven, and it continued flying outside, going and returning until the waters had receded sufficiently from the earth. To see whether the waters had receded enough for survival, Noah later sent out a dove, which at first returned to him, because the dove did not find any perch amidst the waters. Let's look at Genesis 8, 6, and 7, shall we? Just to see what we get for the time when this occurred. So, the ark came to rest, it says here in verse 4. Right, so it might not have actually hit land, but it was at rest. We studied that earlier, right, about a ship coming to rest, it just means it stops moving. And it's on the mountains of Ararat at that time. But then the tops of the mountains appeared after that. So they couldn't even see the mountains when the ship first came to rest. But then the tops of the mountains appeared. And, right, then in verse 8, he sent out a dove. The dove did not find a resting place, verse 9. And it doesn't mention anything else about the landing of the ark or anything specific about touching land. That's what I wanted to check. I was sure that there was, in my mind at least, some question about that. But anyway, let's see whether, but I mean, there's no real doubt about it. The Bible doesn't contain everything possible. It doesn't contain all the possible information. Nothing could. No book could ever cover everything. It contains whatever information was retained and passed on from generation to generation, either through oral word or written word. Now, to see whether, yeah, we read that already, the dove did not find any perch. 7 days later, Noah sent it, and the dove came back with a fresh olive leaf, and Noah knew the waters were abating. So, this is what happened at the time when the ark was landing in the mountains of Ararat, right? We don't know whether it had landed yet on the actual surface of the mountain. After another 7 days, he sent it, and it did not return. When Noah sacrificed some of the animals upon the altar he had built, this was later after they had landed, Jehovah smelled a restful odor, and he stated, quote, all days of earth, seed sowing and harvest, cold and heat, or summer and winter, and day and night, will never cease. Genesis 8:22. A lot of these links, some of the links that were to the Noah's Ark, the Nakshuan site, have been taken by commercial gaming people, and they're not. I'm not promoting that. That's just the website name was. Subsumed by these other people and is in control of some commercial group, apparently, instead of being an educational site, which it used to be. But Genesis 8:22, day and night will never cease, but also, look, cold and heat will never cease. Summer and winter will never cease. So as long as the earth endures, these things will never cease. But that doesn't we shouldn't take that as meaning that this cold and heat of summer and winter will go on forever. We don't know that's true. It's just that until the new earth is instituted, you know, these conditions will prevail. This cold and heat that causes tree rings and suffering as well, right? Summer and winter that apparently didn't exist even at all prior to the deluge, because there were no tree rings in the wood of the ark, as we saw. In future, God's judgment was not to be by water but fire. And that's kind of a long story, but you can look up the Bible references. It says that in the Bible, that this judgment by water was only to occur once, and then there would be later a judgment in the future by fire, not by water, not a second time. In dog breeding, the variation between breeds shows that a great amount of genetic diversity may exist within a kind. In this case, the dog kind. Now, for example, wolves are the same variety as dogs. One single animal specimen is thus very valuable, since it has the genes to produce great variations within its kind. We may understand that Noah took a risk sending out birds, since each bird is so valuable because of its genetic diversity contained in the genome of each bird, right? It's very valuable. Even after all the animals were debarked from the holds of the ark, which must have been fairly lengthy of a process, you would think. None of it is talked about in the Bible, about how they got all the animals off the ark. So we shouldn't be surprised that it doesn't mention how the ark landed either. I have visions of Noah returning again and again to the ark to gather wood to his nearby camp, I wrote at the time of this article when I was writing this. Some of the upper deck is described as having collapsed, a result, I guess, of the numerous, and the fridge finally went off, thankfully, wood scavenging missions. Subsequent generations moved further down Mount Mashu, and the original place of first descent was turned into a graveyard over time, remembered by a few faithful ones who pass on the message of their ancestors, a channel of the truth. The pure language is the understanding of what enables the true worship to be propagated by Jehovah's word. And what is the meaning of that word today? In any particular time, the return to the pure language prophesied by Zephaniah is enabling people all to call upon the name of Jehovah, God. In Elijah's day, there was false worship of Baal or Belus or Beelzebub, as he was variously called. And Elijah gathered the people to Mount Carmel. In the competition there held, Baal could not light a fire with dry wood, but fire from Jehovah came down, licking up 12 large jars of water and incinerating wood and offering. So Elijah even poured 12 large jars of water on the offering just to show how powerful Jehovah was, that he could not only light a fire with dry wood, but he could lick up that much water as well and light the fire at the same time. A miracle. That's the end of the article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express. We've got some notes to cover, perhaps, in the next day or two, maybe. I'm not sure exactly how long it will take us to cover. But that's it for the article. We've finished the article, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express. Congratulations if you've been following with us. We've done that, and we've learned, when we studied the theory of the expanding universe, you could see how the evidence for that is not even quite as convincing, perhaps, as the evidence for the Ark of Noah. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that's tangible for the Ark of Noah, whereas the proof of the expanding universe is difficult because we can't even tell how far away a star is by looking at it. We have to, you know, do something specifically, unusual, right? We have to find a particular type of star, and Henrietta Leavitt had to make a graph that showed it was a straight line, and then we had to you know, I mean, do all these calculations just to prove that there were other galaxies further away, and all, and then the fact that there was a redshift, we had to look at that and say, well, it looks like space is expanding, and that's not really very well proven, is it? Compared to, I mean, not that the work wasn't good, just that there's just not a lot of information about how we can learn about the universe compared to something like we can study on Earth. It's quite difficult. I want to show you something. I don't know. We're going to have time, I think. Are we? Looks like we might have time. I want to show you this video here. Where is it? Where was it? Is this it? No. Is that it? Let's see. Here it is. Yeah, we looked at the Doppler shift, but I got into trouble because I forgot. There's a difference in simultaneity between different reference frames also. Different reference frames have a different perception of simultaneity. So let's look at the train tunnel paradox, perhaps, here. Let's look at this. Come on.
Thank you, Brilliant, for sponsoring this video and supporting Flow Rate Physics. Here's the train, and here's the tunnel. The train, as you can see, is slightly bigger than the tunnel. But, according to the special theory of relativity, moving things are length contracted in the direction of the motion. Which means, if this train was moving very close to the speed of light, then you can see it becomes smaller than the tunnel, and I can trap it momentarily. Did you see that? Let's see one more time. This time I'll slow down time so we can see it better. Here we go. Alright, I close the door, and look, look, look. For a moment, that train is trapped right now. It's not at rest, it's moving, I've just paused time. But that's the important part, okay? I can trap it because of length contraction. And then
see, that's a consequence of the fact that moving objects are length contracted according to our reference frame, right? Because we're not moving in our reference frame, or so we think. So let's, the other thing, let's jump ahead now to the other reference frame. Okay, this is it here.
It fits inside the tunnel. So the question is, what will the people in the train see? Well, let's run the animation.
To them, their train is not length contracted, and they see the tunnel as length contracted. So how are they going to fit in the tunnel?
Here we go. Slow down time. And, that happened.
They don't fit, so there's a paradox, right? So how are we going to resolve the paradox here? That's the question. And that's what we're going to watch, I think.
The doors get stuck, and that causes a paradox. On one hand, we know that motion is relative, which means it's absolutely correct to say that the train is at rest, and it's the rest of the world that is moving backwards. So both frames are equally valid. And yet, in one frame, we see that the doors do not hit the train. But in the other frame, we see that the doors do hit the train. But both cannot happen at the same time. The doors either hit the train or they don't. That's not relative. That's an objective truth. And that's the reason why here is a paradox. So what's going on over here? How do we solve this? Einstein says, Mahesh, just remember, the speed of light is the same in all reference frames. And I tell Einstein, I know that. But how does that help me resolve this paradox? I didn't get it initially. But then I incorporated that into the animation and boom, the paradox got resolved. So the promise of the video is I won't tell you what's going on. Instead, we will visually discover together how the fact that speed of light is a constant in all reference frames means there is no paradox over here and get a much deeper intuition behind special relativity. So if you're ready for this, let's begin. Einstein, first of all, tell me what is wrong in this animation. And Einstein says, Mahesh, you haven't considered the mechanism of the door closing. I'm like, what do you mean? So Einstein says, look, over here, as the train comes closer, Somehow, there is some sensor somewhere that will send the signal to the doors exactly when to close, right? Since you haven't considered that mechanism through which the signals are traveling, you aren't considering the speed at which the signals are traveling, which is the speed of light, and making sure that that speed stays the same when you change reference frame. All of that is being omitted, and that's why you're getting the paradox. If you consider the mechanism carefully, whatever mechanism you want, but if you consider it carefully, then there will be no paradox. I'm like, okay. Cool. So I need some kind of a sensor to help the doors close at just the right time. And I came up with one.
The quantum...
No. Just a minute here. We're not watching ads. I don't respond to unsolicited ads, okay? I don't watch them.
Two buttons. Okay? When the train comes on this, clicks on this particular button, it sends out a light signal. And when that light signal hits this button, it'll send out another light signal. And that's how the doors will shut down. Let me just show you. Here we go. Boom. Here's the first light signal. And while animating, I have to make sure of just one thing. The light travels in all the directions at the same speed. That is true in every single inertial frame, right? So light is going to go out in all the directions exactly the same speed. And look, when the light hits the second button over here, it sends out another light signal. Again, traveling in all directions at the same speed. That's the core thing over here. And now the mechanism that I say is, when these signals hit the doors, that's when the doors are going to fall. Whenever they hit the door. Now, in this particular case, I made sure that this button is right in between the two, so that both the signals are going to hit the door at exactly the same time, and so the door will close exactly at the same time. Let's have a look at it. Boom. And there we go. Let's look at the whole thing one more time, with all the signals and everything, without pausing. Are you ready? Let's go. Now we are ready to look at things from the train's perspective. So, going back, from the train's perspective, the train is at rest, so it will have the normal length, and everything else is moving towards it, so it will be length contracted. Again, when the button moves towards it, let's see, it creates a light signal. But now the important thing is, from our perspective, we are at rest, the light will always be moving away from this point at the speed of light in all the directions. That is the thing that I need to make sure of this, okay? So, take a look at that. The light will expand in all the directions at the same speed as before. There you go. There you go. And now comes the key moment, folks. When this hits over here and it creates a light signal, again, the same thing should happen. Light is going to travel in all the directions at exactly the same speed. However, because this whole thing is now moving towards the train, the doors are moving towards the left. So now, can you see what's going to happen over here? I want you to pause the video and think about this. Since this door is moving towards the light, it's going to hit the light first. And therefore, this door is going to fall first. But since this door is moving away from the light, it's going to take more time for the light to catch up to this door. Can you see that? The speed of light is still the same. So, I'm going to play the animation now. Watch it carefully. Here goes. Look at that. It's going at the same speed, and it hits the door here first. This means, from the train's frame, this door is going to fall first, and look, the door does not hit the train. So you can see right in front of your eyes, we're discovering the key to the resolution over here. And now the big question is, when will this door close? Well, I just have to wait for this light signal to come and hit this door over here. Now the anxious part for me, while I was looking at this animation, the rendered part for the first time, was when will that happen? Will it wait until the train clears it or not? Will this door get stuck or not? Because I've tried to make the physics as perfect as possible over here. So let's watch it together, folks, in its full glory. What will it look like from the train's perspective? Are you ready for this? Let's go. Clears it! There you go! Wasn't that incredible? When I first looked at it, it just clicked. I feel visual discovery is one of the coolest ways to learn things. And if you want to visually discover more concepts for free...
So, I think that's it for that. The part I'm having trouble with right now is... After the light's emitted here... We're looking at it from the point of view of the train, right? So, let's go back right here. Right. Okay. So when... Let's just go... I guess it's hard to go back just a tiny bit here. Right. When the light is first emitted... There. That point is just in front of the train, right? That's the point... And that center of that circle stays at that same relative point in front of the train, because that's what happens. Light is moving at the speed of light. C is the speed of light. Moves at the same speed in all reference frames, no matter what. So even in the reference frame of the train, it's as though it was emitted from this point in front of the train, and the reference frame of the train is at rest. So, I mean, as far as the passengers on the train, they don't see that they are moving. They just see that the world is rushing in upon them. They feel like they're sitting down, stationary. So this point just doesn't move. The point from which the light emanated stays in front of the train as it was when it was first emitted. See? That's what allows... And then the world is moving toward the train from the train's perspective. So its length contracted, and it results in what we just saw. So anyway, that is... It shows how difficult and unintuitive relativity can be. I mean, it can be so difficult. Even for scientists, it's very difficult. And that's why most of the accounts online that you're going to see, most of the YouTube videos and all the explanations that you see, most of them will be wrong. Okay, keep that in mind. I think that particular website and that YouTube channel gives accurate, good, you know, reliable, hopefully, but good, very good descriptions of Einstein's theory and how that works, but that's not true of all others, so be aware. Now we are down to the last minute or two of our video for today. So wasn't that amazing how because of the difference in the relativity of simultaneity, see, the simultaneous nature of the events changed between the different reference frames. And the speed of light is the only thing that we know of that, I mean, if it weren't constant, how would we keep track of anything? But if it is constant for the different reference frames, and that's just a postulate that Einstein made, then it results in, you know, the rest of the physics, which comes out of it. And it's consistent with the Doppler shift, as we talked about. That idea, but it's also consistent with, it has nothing to do with the expansion of the universe. I mean, that's totally a different, has nothing to do with relativity specifically. It's just a way of explaining the redshift of the galaxies. But anyway, but all of what is observed through relativity, you know, with regard to the slowing down of clocks and all that happens in real life, that's accounted for by the theory of relativity, is explained by that postulate that the speed of light is the same for all observers. And it's January 23rd, today, 2025 of the Common Era, and the time is 2048 hours Canadian Eastern Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much, and thank you so much for listening and watching. And in my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Stara saying bye for now. And that was the end today of the article with... without the notes so far, but the end of the article, the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. So, hope you enjoyed.